Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Samuel Scheffler, who is university professor and professor of philosophy and law at New York University. He is the 2012 Tanner Lecturer at the University of California at Berkeley. Sam, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you very much. I spent many happy years here, and it's wonderful to be back.
What can philosophy contribute to public discourse? How I know that in your work you focused on public issues. What contribution do you think philosophy makes in that regard?
It's always a very hard question to answer about philosophy, what kind of contribution it makes. And I find that it generally works best if you don't worry too much about it. Mm-hmm. Philosophy, to me, is in part sort of a way of wondering about the world, a way of being curious about the world. And issues of public concern, which have interested me, though they've not been my exclusive interest, raise questions that are deep and fascinating and elicit sort of natural philosophical curiosity. And so when philosophers turn their attention to issues of public concern, they contribute something, a way of reflecting to public discourse. And there's no telling what effects it will have or when. And I think that the demand that philosophy deliver some specifiable results in the short term is probably misplaced and unrealistic. I like to think that it enriches the public conversation, but its effects are going to be unpredictable.
And part of what this is about is really clarifying the issues, sort of mapping the terrain to help people think?
That's right. Philosophers are sensitive to conceptual distinctions, to structures of argument as a matter of sort of professional disposition. These are sorts of things that we worry about and are attuned to. And I think in the modern age, now more than ever, with sound bites and media food fights and a level of public discourse that is often not very edifying, it's especially useful to have someone or some group of people who want to take the time to contribute conceptual clarification and demand some rigor in the way arguments are presented and so on, though that's, of course, not all that philosophers do.
And central to this is really about framing issues. Let's take a problem and look at it and see what the dimensions of the problem are.
That's right. I mean, often, you know, public issues in particular, someone will, a politician or some media figure will frame an issue for purposes of public debate in a certain way, and a lot is driven by the way it's initially framed. And if the way it's initially framed is not especially helpful or illuminating, it's possibly even misleading in certain respects, that can exert, an unfortunate influence on the way the subsequent conversation goes.
And what are the difficulties of this process of framing? If you have an issue that is controversial, what is the process like in laying out the discourse in a way that reflects the kind of insights of philosophy?
Well, I think that a central fact to be reckoned with, both in philosophy and in public life, is that the issues are often extremely complicated. Philosophers, in their professional conversations with one another, have the luxury of taking that complexity seriously. And so philosophical debates amongst philosophers often strike outsiders as being extremely dense and complicated and so on, and inaccessible often. When it comes to issues of public concern, though, there's in a way the opposite problem. That is, the issues are just as complex. What to do about problems of climate change or, you know, any about the economic problems and so on. The issues are extremely complicated, but we live in a, but our public culture demands simple formulations. And so, and politicians or other people who have a stake in some policy orientation will often rush to frame the issue in a way that they think will be to their advantage. Inevitably, they both oversimplify the issues and often conceal the interests that lie behind that particular way of oversimplifying the issues. So occasionally it can be useful for, I don't want to oversell the virtues of philosophy. Occasionally it can be useful to have someone come along, doesn't have to be a philosopher, it can be any thoughtful person really, and simply call attention to the fact that the issues are being oversimplified, to the ways they're being oversimplified, and to try to persuade people to see things in a slightly different way.
I like to ask my guests what skills they think are involved in the work that they do. So, what is ideal training for somebody who wants to do philosophy and has to develop a set of skills? And what are those skills?
Well, some of the skills are fairly readily identifiable. Philosophy is a discipline that demands a certain competence in argument, in sensitivity to structures of reasoning, in understanding what counts as a reasoning and what counts as a valid argument and what doesn't. So an ability to engage in critical thought more generally and analytic thought is certainly central to philosophical training in all its forms. There's also, philosophy is a subject with a history, a very long history, and many of its problems have histories. And it's important for people who want to come to understand philosophy or to study it deeply to learn something of its history. Questions can be framed for the first time in the present, but often they're illuminated by understanding the ways they've emerged and the traditions of thought that have grown up around them over time. So that's another important dimension of philosophical thought. There's also a role, though it's somewhat less frequently commented upon, for the imagination in philosophy. Sometimes being a good philosopher requires seeing things in different ways. And it's not just a matter of analyzing an argument or detecting a fallacy. Or remembering what some great philosopher said and thinking about what he or she might have meant. But it's a matter of sort of inviting people to see things in a different way, and that requires certain kinds of imaginative skills which are less easily taught.
So in philosophy, is creativity, are there some features of creativity in philosophy that are distinctive, or is it the general problem of creativity in all fields?
Well, it's a certain kind of creativity. I mean, it's not, you know, the kind of creativity that a painter displays or a musician, but it certainly is creativity, and it's very difficult to teach creativity. So some of the problems or questions that arise about the creative process certainly apply to the best work in philosophy, the most original work, which often involves insight and imagination, creating formulations and ideas and ways of seeing things that haven't occurred to others before.
What about temperament? Are there qualities to the temperament of a philosopher that are very important?
Philosophers have as much variation with respect to their temperaments as any other group of people. There are some who are cool and reflective, and there are some who are, you know, sort of much more impetuous and intuitive. I think all philosophers have some respect for the complexity of the issues that they're dealing with. And if there's a common temperament, really, it's a temperament, it's the trait of being fascinated by and responsive to the complexity of philosophical issues and the willingness to tolerate the fact that philosophical questions don't get answered decisively. On the whole, the deepest questions don't, in the way that questions in the natural or social sciences might do.
So it sounds like there can be a great deal of frustration in the process of unraveling philosophical puzzles.
Absolutely. And certainly philosophy is not a field for people who want quick answers and to make quick progress. Philosophers are still arguing about things that, you know, that the Greeks were arguing about thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little about what leads a philosopher like you to particular problems. Is it your education, your background, or what that leads you to focus on some subset of problems in philosophy?
Well, that's an interesting question, Harry. You know, in a way, this is one of the hardest things that one has to learn as one goes on and becomes an academic, probably in any field, but certainly in philosophy. You know, when you first encounter a subject like philosophy as a student at the university, typically, your teachers tell you what the questions are. They give you assignments. They tell you paper topics or set you exam questions. And so you don't have to worry about what the questions or topics are, what's interesting. Somebody tells you what's interesting. And then one day, you know, you get a PhD and you're turned loose on the world as a professional philosopher if you're fortunate enough to find employment. And then suddenly there's nobody telling you what the questions are anymore. You have to decide for yourself what's interesting and what's worth thinking about. Sometimes the ongoing discourse among philosophers itself will simply generate questions that naturally exert a fascination for you, given the things you've been interested in as a student, and so on. So there's a kind of momentum that develops. One thing leads to another, and so on. But increasingly, as you go on, it's always a question what the next new topic is going to be for you. You get tired of thinking about exactly the same things all the time. And it's not a field like science in which it's pretty, you know, the field itself, or at least this is a non-scientist's perspective, the field itself exerts sufficient momentum that it's pretty clear to people what the next sort of set of issues might be in a given field that you'd want to explore. Philosophers, again, there's an element of serendipity to it. Sometimes something just pops into your head as something that seems curious or interesting or fascinating and worth pursuing. And philosophers then have the luxury of being able to follow their ideas wherever they may lead. So it's a mix, I think, of professional sort of agendas that kind of exert their own weight and an element of imaginative and serendipitous circumstance that leads one to select a particular question. And then sometimes there are issues in the wider culture that simply suggest questions that hadn't loomed as salient before, and philosophers or some philosophers will take those up.
One of the topics that you have focused on is, and that emerges in some of the pieces that I read, your Tanner lectures and some of the essays in your book, Equality and Tradition, is the notion of valuing. Just out of curiosity, how does that example fit into what you describe as to how you wound up to talk about? How did you wind up focusing on that particular problem?
Well, over the years, it seemed to me that questions about the nature of value, but also questions about what it is for a person to value something, kept cropping up as I was thinking about other things. I was thinking, for example, about issues to do with the kinds of obligations that are generated by participation in a personal relationship, say. On the one hand, most of us think that we should treat all people decently, and that moral norms apply to our treatment of people in general, strangers especially, as well as people we know well. But on the other hand, we feel we have special responsibilities to close family members, friends, and so on. And so there's a kind of a tension between the norms that tell us how to treat all people and the norms that tell us we have special things we should do for people we're close to. And this tension manifests itself in our personal lives, and it also manifests itself politically, in tension between sort of more universalist and cosmopolitan strands in political thought on the one hand, and then more identity-based and community-based and nation-based ways of thinking on the other hand. And as more I thought about those sorts of questions, which I did for a number of years, the more I was led to ask, to think that a lot of what seemed to be the source of our special responsibilities toward family members and friends and so on seemed to have to do with the kind of significance those relationships had for us and the ways in which we valued them and what it meant to value those personal relationships. So I began to wonder, and that's just one example, but several different problems led me in a similar sort of way to wonder a bit about what exactly it was to value something. I think in our culture now there's a certain amount of skepticism about valuing. People are skeptical about values. They're suspicious of values. People are more comfortable talking about just desires and wants and so on. It's a discourse that, our culture seems more comfortable with. But I think valuing is a very central human attitude. I think we would be very different and unrecognizable creatures if we didn't value things in addition to just wanting things.
And in the essay that I read, you said about clarifying the importance of this by identifying the features of what one values. Talk a little about that, because you're telling us that there are several features, and in understanding them, you can really understand better this problem of valuing.
Yeah. It's hard to clarify the notion of valuing, and there's a tendency, one natural thought is to think that to value something is just to want it a lot, you know, to have a very strong desire for it, or to have a desire of a certain kind for it. But that didn't seem to me quite right. Sometimes we strongly desire something that we don't especially value. Another thought is that, well, maybe valuing something is just thinking it's a valuable thing. So if you think like some painting is very valuable, maybe that means you value it. But that didn't seem quite right either, because it seemed possible to recognize that something is valuable without, in another sense, valuing it yourself. So I was, in the end, led to the idea that valuing is actually a kind of complex syndrome of attitudes. It partly involves the belief that whatever it is you value is valuable. But it also partly involves being somehow emotionally invested in the thing, such that if something bad happens to it, you're upset, or if it flourishes, you're pleased, and so on. The emotions in question will vary depending on what it is that you value, whether it's an institution or a relationship with a particular person or an artifact, and so on. Also, the things we value generate reasons for us to act in certain ways. If I claim to value, say, my friendship with you, but I'm never led to do anything on that basis, if you call me up and say you need help with something, I say, well, you know, sorry, not interested. And if I keep doing that over time, we'd begin to think that I wasn't being honest or very self-aware if I claim to value the friendship. If you value something, then it gives you reasons to act in a certain way. So I take valuing to be a complex sort of set of attitudes involving beliefs about the item, that it's valuable or worthy or worthwhile, dispositions to feel certain emotions depending on how things go with the valued item, and also a tendency to see the valued item as a source of reasons for me to act in a certain way.
And this syndrome, these features together really clarify, as you just said, everything from your relations to your colleagues to your family to a cause that you might find very important. And I guess that in a modern society, the complexity of what we value really multiplies.
Yes, absolutely. And the first step toward making some progress in this area is to recognize that we do value things. The language of economics and the language of the market and the language of marketing sometimes lead us to believe that everything's just another want to which you can attach a price tag. And it's important to remember and to recover our sense that certain things in life are not things we just want. They're things that matter to us, that are important to us, that we value or care deeply about. And understanding that we have a stake in some things as opposed to others. And once you have that insight, then you begin to see that our values are actually quite complicated and they pull us in different directions and that they need to be understood.
As I thought about your essay on this and what you're saying in some of the essays we'll discuss in a minute, I was struck by that really one of the characteristics of political conflict today is there's so much disagreement about what different groups value. In other words, they value things very strongly, but they are as a political society, we're having difficulty reconciling the different groups to each other with regard to what they value.
Absolutely. For a liberal society in particular, in a way, the central contemporary predicament is the fact that such societies are always pluralistic with respect to values. People differ with respect to their evaluative ideas and commitments, their moral, their philosophical, their religious outlooks and values. And that kind of disagreement is not going to go away in a free society. The only way it can go away or seem to go away is through the autocratic use of state power. John Rawls, great late 20th century political philosopher, said that what he called the fact of reasonable pluralism was the fundamental fact that liberal thinkers had to come to terms with in thinking about how social institutions should be structured. And it's obvious just from 5 minutes' attention to the newspaper that conflicts of value and differences of value are a central and enduring feature of our society. And if we want to have a flourishing society, we somehow have to figure out how to go on and how to function together despite those enduring disagreements. And the further complication, of course, is that any decision about how we're going to go on is itself going to have to be based in some values. But since we disagree about values, it's quite difficult to see how we can forge a unified basis for structuring our disagreements and allowing one another to pursue and respect the different values that we have.
And that's really what toleration is all about, learning to respect the values of others.
Yes, toleration is itself a rich concept, and it's sometimes understood exclusively, as it were, as a kind of remedial value. You know, we've got two warring sects, and after a few hundred years of doing battle and killing each other, they finally decide that it's just too costly and they might as well live and let live. And we sort of, you know, better to get along and to stop shooting than to keep fighting forever. And so we tolerate one another in a thin or minimal sense just when we decide not to fight. But toleration also can be understood as a richer value, a value which sees some affirmative worth to constructing a society on the basis that we are going to actually accommodate and encourage people to lead lives in accordance with the values and norms that seem authoritative to them, so far as it's possible to accommodate them all jointly, and that that's actually a good way of living together and not just a way of catching our breaths in between battles.
It was interesting because I was reading in this morning's paper about the Koran burning in Afghanistan, and that is a case where two different peoples are coming at each other with different traditions and find it very difficult to comprehend the values of the other, and there seems to be no organizing structure to create the kind of tolerance we're talking about, as you might have in a place like the United States itself.
Right, and certainly the context of a war involving countries and groups from very different religious and national and cultural backgrounds is not a very promising breeding ground for building structures of toleration, which generally take a very long time to emerge and are somewhat precarious even under the best of circumstances. But it's also interesting in those kinds of cases, unfortunate as they are, remind us how important values are in people's lives. You might think that what people would get most inflamed about were conflicts over just territory or resources or something. But the things that really seemed to provoke the greatest fury and to be the hardest to control or to manage or to get beyond are things that outrage the values and sensibilities that offend against things that a particular group holds dearest.
And interestingly enough, in thinking about the Quran burning, as I did after I had read your essay, that really all the elements come into play, namely the something is valuable because of the tradition. There are strong emotions, and then people act on it in ways that, you know, the other might feel is unreasonable, but those people feel that it's very reasonable.
Sure. And we give, and there's sort of, and people who commit outrages like Quran burning give tacit testimony to the or recognition to the importance of values, because they know that the way to really insult and offend and outrage someone is to attack what they value most deeply. And so they don't just thwart a significant desire that people have. They attack the things that really matter to people.
I read two of your essays, and one on immigration and one on terrorism, and it really struck me when I put them in the context of your lectures and this discussion of valuing that both were at heart really about that different context. So that for you in this essay, immigration really is about learning to adjust what you value given a kind of a new context. And here we're talking about national identity and the identity of the immigrant. Talk a little about that, because it's coming to terms with that, which is very important politically in the discussions that we're having now.
Yes, questions about immigration are controversial for many different reasons. But one of the reasons they're controversial is that depending on the particular kind of immigration that we're talking about, where people are coming from and where they're heading, they often appear to involve bringing into close proximity people who previously weren't in close proximity and who have very different traditions, values, attitudes, customs, ways of life, and so on. And they do that under circumstances where there's a lot of kind of often economic pressure. So the stakes are high, tensions are raised, and what looks to be happening is that you get a conflict between different cultures, the culture of the host country, the culture of the immigrant groups, and so on. And those kinds of conflicts can be very difficult and dangerous to negotiate. One of the aims in the essay that you referred to was to enter a dissenting note about the way in which these issues are sometimes framed. This is a case in which, to go back to the issue you raised at the very beginning, it seemed to me that some of the ways in which the discourse about immigration and conflicts about immigration have been framed have not been especially helpful.
And in a way, it's the interest groups on both sides, that is, the people in the homeland and then the people who have come here as immigrants, you know, they fix on aspects of the problem that really intensify the conflict. So, for example, you have in that essay a very interesting discussion of the multiple identities of a Jewish person from Eastern Europe who came to the United States, and really his identity is much more complex as a result of who he was back in his home country, what he becomes as a result of immigrating, and what he becomes as a result of settling in the United States.
Yeah. One of the things that seems to me misleading about a lot of the discourse about immigration on all sides of the issue is that people frame it as a conflict between the culture of the immigrants and the culture of the host society in a way that suggests that everybody has a culture. You know, you've got your culture, I've got my culture. And then, you know, if I migrate from my country to your country, we've got a problem because I've got my culture, but I'm in your country and you've got your culture. And what are we going to do now? You're used to just having your culture in your country. And this whole way of talking and thinking, it seems very natural, but it overlooks the fact that culture is a kind of protean notion. People belong to many different groups and have many different kinds of allegiances, regional, geographic, racial, sexual, ethnic, professional, identifications based on their interests and so on. And different of these identifications and different forms of group affiliation are salient for people in different contexts. If one person's from Mississippi and another person's from New York, and they visit their respective states, each may feel sort of culturally alien in the other person's state. But if the two of them meet in, you know, India or in Africa, they may feel like they're cultural, you know, brothers. And that's just a way of saying which culture you belong to isn't a question that always has a unique, privileged answer. And that's actually that the recognition of that fact is crucial to, I think, seeing how we might solve not only problems of immigration or some of them, but also other problems of living in a diverse society. It's important to remember that human beings are socially extremely sophisticated and we lead extremely complicated lives. We move in many different circles and many different things and many different kinds of people are important to us in different contexts. We don't just have fixed cultures that we sort of acquire like a set of luggage at a certain age and then carry with us through life. We're always sort of moving around the social world, acquiring new affiliations, and some of them are more salient in some contexts than in others.
And really, as you explicate this problem in this way, the reader sees really the dangers of politicization of these issues because they tend to want the political discourse often wants to fixate on and make lock in cement, so to speak, the one identity as opposed to the but really what it's all about is learning to adjust your values in these new contexts.
That's exactly right. That is the difficulty with the discourse that I was alluding to is that once you insist on labeling people as belonging to a certain culture, and that's their culture, then it locks them and you into certain fixed sorts of relationships, whereas it's essential to being a member of a free society that one of the things you do is that you acquire new identifications, and some you deepen, and some you perhaps shed as you go through life. In circumstances of immigration, where people are uprooted from one place and put down in another place, it's going to have effects on everybody. Nobody's culture is going to remain unchanged. It's a new experience for the person who's migrating, and it's a new experience for the person in the host society that receives the migrant. Each now is going to have to come to terms with a new situation. And that doesn't mean, on the one hand, that either side has to completely abandon all of its previous values, customs, and so on. That's preposterous. On the other hand, it does mean that each of them is going to have to make some adjustments. And no sensible solution to problems of immigration can proceed on a basis which denies those fairly obvious and banal observations. And yet a lot of the discourse would suggest otherwise. It would suggest that what we have is, you know, some group of others who come with their culture and we've got our culture as if we were all the same and belong to the same culture suddenly. Never mind that before the immigrants came, we were locked in a culture war within our own country. So there's a vast oversimplification, and its effects are almost exclusively pernicious.
Another essay that I read, and again, what I'm trying to do is just walk the audience through just a few of the essays of the many publications that you have in order to sort of reveal your way of thinking and a philosopher's way of thinking. And you have I was interested in your article on terrorism, because really in the end that was identifying a goal of terrorists that in essence is about undermining and destabilizing what we value, basically. So it, in a way, it's the same kind of problem. So what are terrorists up to, and what are their and what are the implications of that for society and the social support for what we value?
Well, this is another case in which the framing discourse, it seems to me, oversimplifies the issues in ways that obscure rather than illuminate what's at stake. The very definition of terrorism is itself now a politically contested issue. Some people, the governments and states that are subject to attack by insurgent groups of one kind or another, often want to define terrorism in a way, in such a way that it applies to those and those groups and only those groups and others like them. On the other hand, advocates for those groups sometimes want to say that, no, the terrorists are the governments that they're fighting against and so on. And pretty soon, the term terrorism just becomes a political football and we lose any sense of what might be distinctive about terrorism. It struck me that when people respond with horror and outrage to terrorism, or to what they call terrorism, there is a certain kind of central class of cases, at any rate, in which there is something morally distinctive going on, that so-called terrorist activity is different from other forms of even quite horrible violence. Terrorist acts have something special about them, at least certain kinds of terrorist acts. So without trying to enter into the question of what the best way to define terrorism is or to decide who ultimately terrorists are, I wanted to try to unearth this phenomenon that we often, if not uniformly, label with the term. And what seemed to me to be peculiar to at least this class of cases of terrorist activity was that they tend to involve the use of violence against civilians with the aim of causing fear in lots of other people, and the secondary targets, if you like. The primary targets might be the victims of the violent, the bomb attack or the shooting or whatever it is. The secondary victims are all the rest of the people in the surrounding society who become frightened or alarmed by the terrorism. And the ultimate and a further aim of the terrorist is that fear should itself serve to destabilize or to erode the stability or security of the society itself in ways that will make it harder for people to live the lives that they want to lead, to erode their capacity to lead valuable lives or to pursue the things that they value in a secure situation. So there's this kind of moral cascade in these kinds of cases, which I call the standard cases. The terrorist uses violence against one set of people to create fear in another set of people with the aim of eroding or destabilizing the structures of society more broadly.
Two things about this essay, well, three things struck me. One is the clarity of laying out this very controversial problem, which had been the discourse had really been corrupted by the way the Bush administration tried to frame the issues. But one was the reference to Thomas Hobbes in the philosophical tradition, and you quote from him about the eroding, destabilizing effect of fear. And I had forgotten my Leviathan, and it really was an amazing description. So this is a case where going back to the philosophy discipline and its leading writers from the past really explicates the problem.
That's right. Hobbes was, of all the great writers of tradition, he's the one who most clearly emphasized the potentially destabilizing character of fear, and in some, its capacity to sort of unravel an individual's personality and to unravel the social order. And in a way, Hobbes made the desire to avoid fear central to his whole political philosophy. And it seemed to me that in that sense, terrorists of the kind I'm talking about, at any rate, are Hobbesians. That is to say, they too appreciate the power of fear, and they try to turn it to their advantage. Incidentally, it's not only terrorists who do that. Totalitarian governments also try to exploit the power of fear, but they have, in a way, the opposite purpose in mind. They want to stabilize a kind of corrupted social order. They want people to be afraid so that they won't step out of line. And so fear is a very potent political weapon. It's used in different ways, both to destabilize certain kinds of social orders and to try to stabilize them.
And that was my other point, which is that from the essay emerges a very clear picture of the difference between terrorism and state terrorism. And in the public discourse, these terms are used very loosely. So one side says the other, oh, no, the state is using terrorism, and the state, of course. But this sort of clarifies what the differences are. One is trying to undermine the order, whereas the state is trying to preserve the order.
Yeah, that's right, with one small qualification. I don't want to deny that states, too, can engage in terrorism in my sense. They may foment terrorist activity in other countries, for example. A particularly cynical and Machiavellian government might actually sponsor terrorism in its own society as a way of inviting, a demand for them to crack down. But the distinction I drew was between what I call terrorism and state terror as a different phenomenon, the phenomenon of using fear, which states can also do, to try to stabilize the order that they control.
Let's talk briefly about your Tanner lectures. It's a very provocative, insightful cut into the problem of valuing, actually. What in your lectures do you mean by the afterlife? And please.
Well, the title of the lectures is The Afterlife, but that's, of course, a bit of a tease because I'm not really talking about the afterlife as people traditionally think of it. I'm not talking about the idea that you or I might survive our own deaths in some form. That idea is, of course, central to many religious and philosophical traditions. But I was interested in a different idea, and I chose the term afterlife partly just to be provocative, but partly also to try to explore the relative significance to us of the traditional notion of the afterlife and this other idea of mine. The idea of the afterlife I was concerned with is the idea that other people will live on after I die. So even if I don't believe that I personally am going to have an afterlife, I do normally take it for granted that other people are going to live on after I die. I mean, I rarely sort of reflect seriously about it. It's not something that it occurs to me to question very often. I just, of course, take it for granted that others will live on. The lecture, however, the lectures that I've been giving this week take up the sort of invite us to reflect a little bit on the significance of this assumption we make that other people will live on after we die, that there will be what I call a collective afterlife in that sense, because I believe that it's actually quite important to us. Surprisingly, perhaps, it plays a very significant role in our lives, even though we don't recognize it or reflect about it very often, that if we didn't think anyone was going to live on after we lived, it would have great effects on how we live now. And in particular, it would make us lose confidence in the value of many of the activities whose value we now take for granted. So in some sense, it's extremely important to us that life should go on, the lives of others should go on after we die, if we are to lead lives of value now. Or at any rate, that's the aim of the lectures, is to try to persuade the audience of that.
And what I found fascinating is it's really it the lectures, in addition to offering insight about the basis for what we value, is also indicative of a line of inquiry in philosophical thinking, so that in posing this counterfactual, hopefully it is a counterfactual.
For now.
one, you really provoke thinking about the broader context in which we value things.
That's right. I mean, the striking, I must say that the one of the central counterfactuals that I organize the lectures around is not original to me. It was taken from this wonderful novel by P.D. James called Children of Men. Some people might have read the novel or seen the film that was made in 2006 based on the novel, though it's rather different from the novel. But James asks us to imagine a world in which human beings suddenly become infertile, or by the time the novel begins, they've been infertile for 25 years. So the thought is, without any plot spoilers, I won't say more, but eventually things change in the novel. But the expectation at the beginning of the novel is people are going to die out. There are no new people being born. None have been born in 25 years. So, and the question is, how does that affect people now? And although she doesn't put it in quite this way, her speculation seemed to be that it had a demoralizing effect on people, that people just found it difficult to be enthusiastic about doing many of the things that they'd previously valued most deeply. Many of the activities that seemed to them most important, most worthwhile, now seem somehow pointless, or they just lost confidence in the value of pursuing them. And that seemed to me an extremely striking idea, and I wanted to pursue it a little further and to try to think about, first of all, how far-reaching those effects might be, and second of all, what does that say about us and our values? Isn't it an interesting fact, if it is a fact, that we would lose confidence in the value of things we're now doing in our lives if we thought that there weren't going to be any people in the future? One thing that's interesting about that, a couple of things are quite striking about it. One is that we don't seem to lose confidence in the value of our activities just because we know that we're going to die. I mean, people know that they're going to die, but they mind dying partly because they have so many things that they value doing and they want to keep doing them. They don't think, gee, I'm going to die, so nothing matters. They think, oh, it's how terrible it is I'm going to die, among other reasons, because there are all these things that matter to me that I'd like to be able to do or to see through to completion or so on. So it's interesting to think that the prospect that human beings might die out, even after or one died oneself, could have a demoralizing effect on one's capacity to pursue one's values in this life. The other thing that's interesting about this is that these effects are produced on us not because of our personal attachment to any of these as yet unborn people. They're unborn. We don't know who they are. They have no identities. And yet the fact that they might not come into existence seems to have a more profound effect on us and our values than does the fact that we ourselves are going to die, or even the people we care most deeply about. The fact that they're going to die. None of those things seem to prevent us from maintaining our confidence in the value of the activities that seem valuable to us. But the thought that unborn people in the future might never come into existence, that would strike us as devastating and catastrophic. That seemed to me quite an interesting insight.
And it's fascinating because generally we think about, if we're addressing the problem of climate change, for example, we say, oh, we want to, you know, the future generations are dependent on us, and therefore we want to do something about climate change. But the insight that you discover is that, in a way, we are dependent on them, which is the reverse of what we normally think.
That's right. The prevailing discourse, certainly within philosophy, but I think also in the wider culture, when it comes to thinking about future generations and the effects on future generations of our behavior now, whether it's with respect to global warming or having other destructive effects on the environment, say, The prevailing discourse is to think roughly there's this class of people who are going to exist in the future. They have no power to speak for themselves, but they're very vulnerable to us. If we do stuff, we're going to make their lives miserable. We really ought to pay more attention to that fact, that somehow we have an obligation to protect this vulnerable class of people, the as yet non-existent people who will come into existence in the future. And that makes it seem as if this is a moral burden on us. There's something we should do, as it were, one more set of moral obligations. And people, it's sort of kind of like, you know, we've got to eat our spinach and do what we should do right by future generations, which doesn't seem very successful, by the way, in motivating most people most of the time. But it seemed to me that that discourse really obscured in some ways the most salient feature of our relations to future generations. Of course, they are dependent on us in certain obvious ways, causally dependent. If we pollute the water, they'll have to deal with it. If we make the environment toxic, that will have terrible effects on them. But there is a relation at least as important or more important that runs in the opposite direction. If they don't exist, then what we're doing now doesn't seem worthwhile. And so in a way, we depend on them. And that's a very different kind of reason for wanting to protect them and their interests. Our capacity now to lead lives that we see as valuable depends on our confidence that there will be people in the future. And so if we act in ways that give us reason to lose that confidence, then among other things, we're undermining our own ability to lead valuable lives now.
Now, superficially, one might think that what I value is related to my property, for example, and so therefore it's a very individualistic, egoistic kind of thing. But you're saying really that what we value really depends around not only the people around us, but the people in the future. And so that it's very, at the base of valuing is recognizing that it's a part of, what we value is part of an ongoing history, which then allows us to value that thing. So it's not selfish and egoistic in a way.
Well, I think in a way that the this is a place where the language of egoism and altruism doesn't help us very much. It's one of those dichotomies that tends to oversimplify a complex reality. In terms of the content of their current values, people differ considerably. Some people have values that are in one recognizable sense sort of egoistic. They're focused on themselves and their own satisfactions and gratification. Other people are more, have values that are in the similar sense more social, or they're more oriented toward helping people or helping society. So human beings vary in these respects. But what's interesting is that what I take, what I call the afterlife conjecture to suggest, the fact that people would lose confidence in their values under those circumstances, to suggest is that even people whose values strike us as in one sense fairly egoistic would suddenly find, if they thought that human beings were about to die out, that a lot of stuff that seemed to them obviously worth doing no longer seemed as worth doing. Would you really want to build a real estate empire, you know, as people were gradually fading out? You know, I mean, would venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, would they continue to feel as motivated to do what they were doing if they thought that human life were about to come to an end, for example? So there are lots of different kinds of projects and activities that seem to me to be threatened in the sense that they would no longer seem to make as much sense. I discuss everything from, you know, scientists trying to cure cancer, people trying to work to improve seismic safety in the Bay Area, say, to creative artists or novelists who are writing, to the work of philosophers. Would I really feel motivated to get up and write my next article, say, if I thought that human beings were about to disappear from the planet? Not at all clear that I would. So that it's not just altruists in one sense of the term, but people across a broad array of values who would suddenly find that the things that mattered most to them no longer seemed quite as significant. And that suggests that even though some of us are more and some of us are less egoistic in one sense, we're all rather less egoistic than we might have thought in another sense, namely that we're much more dependent on and vulnerable to catastrophe befalling others or befalling humanity as a whole than we are even to our own personal deaths. Because again, none of the people in question would lose confidence in the value of what they're doing just because they know that they're mortal. We all know that we're mortal, but we think it's important to do what we're doing. But if we thought that the human race were about to die out, then even the egoists among us might find that they no longer saw much point in what they were doing. And to the extent that that's true, it suggests that they, too, are more vulnerable and dependent on others than we might have thought. And one thing I take away from that is that the language of egoism and altruism doesn't describe very well the nature of the ways that human beings are intertwined with one another.
One final question, and that relates to students who might be watching the program. Do you have any suggestions or advice about how they should prepare for the future if they want to follow a similar or a comparable intellectual journey and engage in philosophical inquiry?
Well, I don't think that I have any very original or novel advice. I think for someone who's entering the subject, the best thing to do is simply follow the time-honored path of trying to learn about the philosophical tradition, to study its great works, to familiarize oneself with the habits of thought, and to try to enter into those habits of thought as best one can, with an eye toward eventually being able to pursue the philosophical questions that matter most to one. The one thing I would say is that, and any philosopher would say this, is that philosophical education can't be just passive. The description I just gave might have made it sound that way, you know, go read the great philosophers, study the great works. But from the earliest phase of philosophical study, philosophical education has to be active. You have to be reading these things and learning about them, but part of the way you learn about them is by thinking about them, by talking about them with other people, by trying yourself to address the philosophical questions, to use your own intellectual resources as best you can to try to work out what you think about certain questions. And of course, over time, your answers will become more sophisticated and refined. It's not that on your first day you're going to produce a publishable piece of work, but rather that really the way to appreciate philosophical issues and their complexity is not only to read what others have said about them or to familiarize yourself with the tradition, but it's also a matter of yourself trying to work it out so that you run into the dead ends and you see the difficulties that have led the great philosophers to go this way rather than that way, or you see how the choice points that have divided great philosophers loom up and why people have divided over certain issues. That's really crucial to eventually becoming an independent philosopher yourself.
Well, on that note, Sam, thank you very much for coming back to Berkeley, delivering the Tanner Lectures, and being a guest on our program. This was a very insightful and revealing interview. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Harry. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.